This talk was given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Zuise Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, good morning, everyone. And to those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome. Welcome to Zen Mountain Monastery. This morning is the end of one of our meditation intensives, our sessions, and during Ango, during this 90-day training period, we end each session with a Dharma encounter. And it is it goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha, probably when these encounters happened informally, where wanderers were both practicing with him, but also with many other different teachers, and would encounter one another on the road, or would encounter one another as they settled in groves or caves to practice, and would engage each other in the Dharma. And you know, over time, this became a little bit more formalized in some of the schools. In Zen Buddhism in Japan specifically, Dharma encounter is also done formally, but it is rehearsed. The questions and the answers are known beforehand, and it's a very, very powerful, very dramatic kind of ceremony, but it is set before and is formalized. There's also the practice of debate that is prevalent in Tibetan Buddhism that also has very strict rules of engagement, if you will. And so here we do Dharma encounter, and it is unrehearsed. So the people who will come up don't know what I'm going to speak about, and I don't know what they're going to ask. And so in that way, it's very, very alive. And it is, of course, the way that we help each other to develop in the Dharma. It is also one of the ways, you know, there are different ways in which a teacher-student interact in Zen, both formally and informally. And as many of you know, there's, you know, normally on a Sunday we would end with a talk, a Dharma talk or a Dharma discourse on a particular aspect of the Dharma. There's mando, question and answer sessions, that are slightly more or less formal, in which a teacher presents a particular aspect, again, of the Dharma, and we engage one another in dialogue. There's face-to-face teaching, which happens privately in our tradition, and it is meant to be private, and it is a very short, very pithy encounter between teacher and student, and is really trying to, as much as possible, point directly to the nature of reality. And then there's informal interactions. And so Dharma encounter is a kind of public face-to-face teaching. It gives us, so we're still meeting, you know, one-on-one, but we're doing it in the context of Sangha. And it gives us an opportunity to really learn from one another, to really all aspects of it, you know, both how to come forward when perhaps you don't want to, how to ask a question, how to bring forth all of yourself, you know, to this seat, to this encounter. And because people who engage in this practice, you know, range from beginners to more experienced practitioners, it also gives us a range of expressions of the Dharma. So what I wanted to speak about today is bowing. I wanted to look at bowing. So let me start with this quote that we're using for our art practice from Master Dogen's fascicle, Buddha Ancestors. Actualizing Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and look at them in veneration. It is not limited to Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but it is going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. It is taking up those who have maintained the face and eye of Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and meeting them. They have manifested the virtue of the Buddha ancestors, dwelt in it, and actualized it in the body. So actualizing Buddha ancestors means to bring them forth and look at them in veneration, Master Dogen says. And we're not exactly a reverential culture, not generally speaking, and yet reverence is such a crucial aspect of any spiritual path. And so what does it mean to look at something, to look at someone in veneration, to regard it or them with reverence, with respect? And how does this relate to formally bowing and meeting Buddha ancestors? How is this manifesting the virtue of Buddha ancestors? Who are the Buddha ancestors? In another fascicle, Dharani, also as Master Dogen, he says, when you bow to Buddha ancestors who are nurtured by themselves or by others at places of 100 grasses in the midst of things, of phenomena, you experience Shakyamuni Buddha's attainment of the way, effort in the way, and Dharani, miraculous transformation. When you bow to ancient Buddhas and present Buddhas in countless billions of eons, it is the moment of being wrapped in Shakyamuni Buddha's robe. So in our training, we bow all the time. I would do standing bows, we do seated bows, kneeling bows, full bows, prostrations. Why? What for? In the Tibetan tradition, that full prostration is really full. Your body is completely extended. You're completely flat on the ground. It reminded me of in the Christian tradition where you're taking formal vows. They're also completely flat, face down on the ground, with their arms extended, in this case like the cross. A complete gesture, you could say, of surrender. And again, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's one of the preliminary practices to make 100,000 prostrations, to prepare the body, to prepare the mind to receive the teachings. But what is that act? What is that act of bowing? What happens to body and mind? What happens to your body and mind when you bow? Do you experience it as a moment of being wrapped in the Buddha's robe? Do you experience it as miraculous transformation? Or is it an obstacle? Is it a burden? Is it something that you do because you have to? You're supposed to, even though you don't fully understand it. And if that's the case, that's fine. You know, bring that forth. Let's look at it together. So this is what I want to look at this morning. And so the way that this works is those of you who are formally participating in the Ango, you are invited, you're encouraged to come up. Let's, you know, as always, see if we can get a mix of people. So especially if you've never done Dharma Encounter or if you didn't do it last time, you're especially encouraged to come up. And, you know, then anybody else who would like to. If you want to come up but feel, you know, afraid to do so, know that I share your feeling. So we can be afraid together. But come up. This is really, I mean, it's the only way that we engage the Dharma is really by engaging it, by doing this together. Hogen Sensei was saying this morning is that you can't do it any other way. You can't do it on your own. So please come up. Seishin, who's the chief disciple, will make 3 bows to start. Seiyan will close the line. She'll also do 3 bows. Everybody else will just do 1 bow.
So Shanti, when I bow to you, I bow to your enlightened nature. And as a teacher, you have realized that. And I bow to that. And there's a part in me that is what's bowing.
So, but what does that mean? You know, that's a word that we use a lot, enlightened nature. What is that? So if you have to say this to someone who doesn't know anything about Buddhism, how would you say that?
You have realized who you are.
Which is what?
All of it.
Yes. And what happens when you don't realize it? It's still all there, isn't it?
Yes, but you have all these hindrances to...
Well, I have all these hindrances too, by the way.
But your teaching, you must have seen...
No pressure. So in that act of bowing, so you're saying, you know, that we all have, and we speak of this all the time, we say we have that Buddha nature. And we often will say when we're, you know, trying to bring out what a bow is, you know, we're not bowing to a statue, we're bowing to that which is already awake in us. How does that moment of bowing bring that forth? How does that make it real?
Just the body. Like when you go all the way to the floor, and there are certain parts of the body that we usually, when our ego is very manifest, kind of stiffen, like our knees. And when we bend them, and then we go all the way down and lift our hands up, there is a surrender in the gesture. And that is felt somewhere.
Okay. Okay, and hopefully we can look more at that surrender. Okay. May your life go well.
You know, bowing intention sort of varies often. I mean, sometimes bowing is just bowing, you know, just bow. But then there's that intention of treating somebody with sacredness. So every morning I chant to myself, however many sentient beings there may be, I vow to meet them with kindness and interest. So to see a person is my bow to that person.
And when you said that there are times when a bow is just a bow, in that just bowing, you're not seeing the person? How is that different?
Well, bowing in, you know, what person would I be seeing when I'm bowing during liturgy? I don't see a person, I'll just...
But so when you're coming forth and you're bowing here, for example, and you, it sounded like you made a distinction between just bowing or bowing with the intent to see, to regard that person. So I'm trying to see what that distinction is.
Oh. Well, I might be just, you know, a no mind, a non-thinking thing and bow, that's all, which is not... The intention isn't clear as when you verbalize it. When I verbalize it, it's more people compassion oriented. If I'm just bowing, I'm just bowing.
Yeah, but the question still remains. So when you just bow, is that different from when you have that intent to see or regard that person? So look right there. Look right there. May your life go well.
Thank you.
Sure, Sanchi. You know, when I bow in the Zendo, or when I bow before you in the Daisan room, it's pretty easy. But then there's, you know, especially within my own self, there's parts of me, almost like they're their own personas that I can't bow to.
Why?
Because I can't. I mean, I intellectually can tell you that I see Buddha in that, but I don't feel it. It's not in my heart.
And so not feeling, and what is it that you're not feeling? The fact that they have Buddha nature?
Yeah.
And in that, what prevents you from bowing?
Well, I can make the prostration, but it doesn't feel authentic.
When we do, you know, we do service every day, does it always feel authentic when you bow?
No, there's definitely times where I'm distracted.
Do you bow anyway?
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, depending on how judgmental I'm feeling, sometimes I'm pretty disappointed in myself, and other times I'm kind of just like, whatever. you know, and then other times it feels good.
So does your ability, does your capacity to bow depend on how you feel about it?
I don't know. I think that's where I feel stuck.
So really, really look at that, because living here, you are bowing all the time. And you're saying yourself that you're acknowledging that it doesn't always feel authentic. You're not always wholehearted. You're not always perhaps in it. You're still doing it. Mm-hmm. So what is happening in that moment? And what is happening in your mind that makes you think that there's something preventing you from that bow, that wholehearted bow? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanji. I feel like most of my Zendo bowing is like training wheels. Like I really struggle with knowing whether I'm bowing or not when I go through the prescribed motion. But there's this other thing that I do that feels like bowing, and I wonder if it is. When I go in the woods, go walking in part of the woods that doesn't have trails marked, and I just don't step on the mushrooms. And that, to me, feels like bowing.
Hmm. And when you said that the bowing in the Zendo feels like training wheels, training for what?
For going in the woods and not stepping on the mushrooms.
Uh-huh. It seems to be working.
Mushrooms, for sure. But the struggle that I feel is when I go in the woods, it's not difficult.
Why?
Not step. I feel soft. Like I'm soft, like them, and like all the little salamanders. And with my struggle with the Zen, with formal bowing, is that I try to do it too well. I see how well you bow. I'm not blaming it on you. I have a tendency to want to externalize something that I know, and know from my experience, is actually an internal feeling. And when I bow, I know it. But most of the time, I don't feel like I'm really bowing. I don't really feel that first softening when you go back.
Mm-hmm. So when you said that you don't know if you're bowing, right? You said at the beginning, and it sounds like then there's a way in which you would bow when you would know it. Oh, that was a bow, mm-hmm. Which means that it can either happen or it won't. There's two possibilities. Daito Roshi would always say this, right?
Maybe. Well, it could happen, or I could try to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. What happens if you don't try?
It happens.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Wow, this is scary. You're right.
Yeah, I know.
For me, bowing is feels like when you do it right, which is pretty much never. It's the, like jumping from that 10,000 foot pole.
So first, right. So when you do it right,
you feel, you know, you feel that you're, you go for it.
But what is right?
Completely committed.
And so when you, you know, maybe you come into the Zendo, you're at the temple, you came in for sitting and you didn't sleep well the night before, and, you know, you're tired and you're doing it, but it's, you know, maybe it doesn't feel like it is wholehearted. Are you saying that in that moment, that bow is not right?
I don't think it relates to any physical. It's a, you know, yesterday when you were talking about that road that rises for your feet, you know, that moment that you move in that spiritual path and there's something that, it's the same feeling. It's like, even sometimes I see it when I go with one foot instead of two at the same time, going with two at the same time, when I do two at the same time.
So the reason I'm asking this is because I think I know what you mean. You know, there's a way in which a bow or, you know, anything that we do really from the inside, you know, wholeheartedly, we feel it. It's like everything comes into harmony, right? And there's a kind of settling. But then there's all the many times when that doesn't happen for various reasons. And so what about all of those times? What happens with those? Do we just, you know, cast them aside because they were not right, because they were not wholehearted? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, I know when they're wrong.
So you do know when there's right and wrong. Okay,
yeah,
what do you do when it's wrong?
Well, so used to it. it's like I know when they're wrong.
But what do you do?
I just acknowledge, like I acknowledge that they were not completely fully stepping forward, something was holding back.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Offer that half-hearted bow completely. Just offer that completely. And then where would the wrongness be? May your life go well.
Thank you very much.
Trisanchi. When I bow in the Zendo, I close my eyes and go to the ground. And
how do you know where the ground is?
It meets me.
How does it meet you?
It stops me from continuing to move.
Are you sure?
I feel supported by something when I go down.
Okay.
It doesn't always feel comfortable. I feel like I am intentionally giving up something. I don't always know what it is. Sometimes I can point to it, but it's almost always physically, at least a little bit uncomfortable. And this ango I've found in a way a different kind of bowing through art practice. I've been drawing, which is not my medium. I usually write because it's very safe, even when I fail. Or I feel like what I write is not good. It's still safe. Drawing is very foreign to me. So I've tried to get out of my own way and my judgment by closing my eyes and drawing ancestors in a single line. And sometimes I draw several on the same page without opening my eyes, just move my hand across or down. And when I open my eyes, I feel like it's been one of the deepest surrenders. very uncomfortable, very vulnerable. In a way, I purposely engaged it that way to get out of my head.
When I was speaking the other day about pilgrimage, I was saying that, you know, that there is an aspect of this inner or outer journey that requires that giving up of something, that wearing down of the self that journey entails. And, you know, when it's a physical pilgrimage, you know, it usually involves that travel and the weariness of the travel and perhaps the physical demands of it. And that something happens in that. And I think of that during Sesshin, and somebody was speaking this morning, I think during Open Sozon, about being so tired, because he was sick, right? Chiju, who was sick, and saying, I couldn't, he could just do enough to do what he needed to do. He couldn't hold on. And I've always thought that is such an important part of the way our practice is set up and the schedule is set up, that there's a moment in which you just have to let go. And I was reading, I think it was Lama Zopa, who was talking about bowing, and he was very carefully describing, you know, how to place your hands and how to place your whole body. And he was saying, you know, when you get tired, don't just have the temptation to rest in between bows. He said, you should be standing up, like scurrying like a fox. And he was saying that there's this sense of enthusiasm, but this very much this giving up of what I want in that moment. And I remembered when I was doing all these series of bows, you know, leading up to the transmission. And, you know, at a certain point, I mean, my body was tired. And at a certain point, and I remember talking to Hojin about it, you know, you place your forehead down, you're like, well, I'll just stay here for just a moment. And Lama Zopa was basically saying, in that moment, give that up and just rise back up again, and then you start over. And that is that practice. I was going to say willingness, but sometimes you're not willing. It's that practice of, in that moment, release. In that moment, release. You know, and I was saying to Jamie, maybe it's half-hearted. Okay, release that. Because that's the way to really bow. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanji, when we chant the four Bodhisattva vows, and I bow, I think of bowing to the Buddha nature in all sentient beings. It's easier for me to bow to you than to think of bowing to all sentient beings sometimes for me. Especially like I think about the man who just committed those murders.
I was just thinking that.
You know, yeah. He has Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. How do I bow to that?
Yes, how do you? How do you do that? How do you do that in your mind? How do you do that in your heart?
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I've asked myself that question, you know, many times, and I hold that, and it's, you know, in one sense it's easy to say, well, I would just bow, and I would bow to that Buddha nature, not to the act that he committed, but to his Buddha nature that is so obscured, that it's so distant. But it's one thing to say that. It's one thing to say that, and it's quite another to actually really do it and to do it knowing, in a sense, the resistance or the difficulty or the holding back and doing it anyway. You know, doing it with the faith, with the trust that he does, in fact, have Buddha nature. And again, I mean, I'm saying these words, and it's easy to say that, and I find it incredibly, incredibly challenging to do. And yet I think, you know, a bow doesn't exclude anything. There's nothing that is left outside, so it can't leave him outside, can't leave the victims and their families outside. So that's, you know, what we're sitting in this room, and... and you know, doing our best, you know, trying to, you know, to live clear lives and to see ourselves. And when you're met with the reality of something like this, or the violence of something like this, the sheer sadness of something like that, in that moment to be able to bow, that's a quite different story. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching. Shoshanji, I had the opportunity to lead lunch crew this week, and lunch crew is tough during Sesshin because I think everybody'd rather be resting. And I saw a lot of responses and reactions to being in lunch crew. Some vocally saying, "I don't want to be here." Some being eager to help and to do whatever they wanted, you know, whatever they could do. And I got to see myself in each one of those people, all the good and all the bad, and I was able to realize that there were some aspects of myself, some of those people this week, that I wasn't able to give my full compassion to. So I want to bow. I'd like to say I bow, but I'm not there yet. I want to bow to what we share, to my humbleness, not being above, but not being below. Whatever you have within you, I know I have too. All the bad, every single bad part of you is in me, and every good part is in me as well. I forget that. I know that there's so many times that I don't want to see those bad things. I bow to my humanity.
And I think that's really the key, you know, because it's, we so easily fall into right and wrong, into I'm doing this wholeheartedly or I'm not, into I'm willing to bow to this person or I'm not, which is, you know, still a very, very dichotomous way of looking at it. But if we could really do what you just said, if we could all really do what you just said, then in a sense it would all be taken care of. The humanity, as I said before, it just includes the whole thing. So it's, we, you know, our tendency to parse out, this deserves my reverence, but this doesn't. That is the very thing that keeps us separate. And so that doesn't mean that actions don't matter and that they don't have consequences. Of course they do. And sometimes we have to act in order to bring forth actual goodness, you know, or to change something. So it doesn't put a blanket over our actions. But it means truly trusting and having reverence for that humanity. You know, it's something that we say so easily. You know, we're human and we want to see each other as human until it's right there in front of you. And then we don't really like that humanity so much. So if we could really do that, truly bow to humanity in me, humanity in you, yeah, this would be a very different world. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So I just wanted to bring up this question again, or these words of Master Dogen again. When you bow to ancient Buddhas and present Buddhas in countless billions of eons, it is a moment of being wrapped in Shakyamuni Buddha's robe. What is that?
We bow a lot to a lot of different statues. We bow to the Buddha statue and to the main altar, which also has Kanon and Manjushri on it. We bow to the statue of Mahaprajapati. We bow to the statue of Fudo, the Fudo god, down in the main, sort of the dining hall. And you know that I like archetypal images, and I like to think about why.
Well, you like swords. You do.
It's an it's true. It's an archetypal image in and of itself. And I also like dragons. But what I really like about archetypal images is why we use those archetypal images. What are we bowing to in that image, whether it's a sword or a dragon, or whether it's an image of a person? What is that image representing? So when I bow, I always try to bring the energy of what that image is a representation of into me. Oftentimes during Sesshin, I've noticed that we will get a full moon, probably because it's usually the third or fourth week of the month, and so we get a new moon or a full moon. And whenever there's a full moon, I always try to bow to it.
And what happens when you do that?
I think it's a way of trying to acknowledge and pay reverence to the sort of very archetypal image of change and rebirth. It's also a way, to a certain degree, to pay homage to the sort of feminine energy that's present in the moon and that has been present in the moon for hundreds of thousands of years. It's always interesting to bow during Sesshin to the moon because we're so deep in sort of exploring impermanence and, you know, all of these aspects of Buddhism. And the moon is such a perfect image of that. It's such a perfect image of change.
Okay, and just to go back to what you said about the images, because I think that's a very important point. And Roshi speaks of this every now and then, you know, that when we're setting up an altar, a personal altar, that you want it really to be alive, right? You want it to be, you want yourself to be in dynamic relationship with it, because you're in relationship with an image that is not just, you know, a piece of wood or a stone. It's alive, as you said, and you are in relationship with it. And so I find that over time, my altar at home, my altar here has changed depending on that relationship. And the image that I've needed to have on the altar has changed as well. And that sometimes it's just the representation. Do I put Kuan Yin as opposed to the Buddha? But sometimes it's a lot more subtle. There's the particular expression of a statue or the energy that I feel of the posture of their body. What needs to be around it? Does there need to be anything around it? Right. So I very much feel that I'm in dialogue and communication with this image, which is very true, you know, when we're doing Canton in the morning and we're visiting each of these altars, and there's a Dharani that you do, and there's a kind of a dedication that you do, and each one has a very particular function that you're engaging with in that moment. In a sense, I think of it kind of as activating it. So absolutely, you want, you know, archetypes, I think they're powerful because of that, because they touch into these very primal forces in us, you know, energy and understanding, and that when something clicks, we feel it. So I think it's really important to keep developing that, to never stop developing those relationships. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shasanji, when I bow to you, I'm bowing to the knower within all hearts that you have, by getting yourself out of the way, let shine forth for all of us. When I bow in general, I'm bowing to that luminosity throughout the whole universe that I know is inside of us. Now, that's great and all, but I also know that non-renunciation of samsara is not, nor nirvana, so we can have the best of both worlds by being here and not being consumed by those constructions. So that's what I find to be the Dharmakaya robe that you mention. However, there are two other aspects of this, and that includes that I respond to songs. So before I ever found my way here, the song that spoke best was the song of the Adhidhuk. And there's a phrase that says, "Why dost thou grieve, O mind? Will your homogeneous existence open like sky?" But there's a lot to grieve. So how can one work with this best of both worlds, with this bowing to knowing that that evil, even if I don't call it that, and moment to moment, that that evil is a part of me and inside of me? How can we stay in that unborn, homogeneous existence, open like sky, but also have some sort of difference for those versions of ourselves that don't want to hear it?
Well, you can't stay in that homogeneous existence. Nobody can stay there. And so, you know, sometimes I bow in recognition and in manifestation of that bright luminosity. Sometimes I bow in recognition of the darkness and of my confusion and the confusion that I see in the world.
Thank you for your teaching.
May your life go well.
So, Sanchi, when you brought up the subject of bowing, two teachers and two teachings that I received came to mind. One was a psychiatrist and an academic teacher and a therapist who wanted to come to the monastery. And when she contacted the monastery, they suggested, because she lived in Buffalo, to come and practice with the Zen group there. So she did. And when she encountered the bowing, it was this huge impediment for her. And she, after trying twice to practice with us, she said, "I cannot do this. My upbringing will not allow me to do this." And she walked away from it. The other teacher in teaching...
Do you know what her upbringing was?
I suspect Hebrew.
Okay, but you don't know?
I don't know that. Mm-hmm. Not okay. From the name, I'm pretty sure of that. The other teacher and psychiatrist and my teacher at the time, and I walked into a Catholic church, and I was sort of ahead of him, and I noticed that he stopped, and I turned, and he got my attention. And he bowed. I didn't. And I said to myself, that's the kind of freedom I want. That I want to manifest that kind of reverence. Even though I was used to genuflecting in the church, but it never occurred to me to bow as I crossed the threshold, even though I'm trained to do that here. It was not the thing to do there. But for him, it was. And that's what I want. The other, that shows me how I build walls in my mind, and I work hard to disassemble those through the training here. So I've never had a problem bowing. I really try to throw myself into it, let it help wake me up in the moment, and it gives me an opportunity to thank the Buddha for his journey. You know, he left his wife, his child, and he set out. I mean, that's a lot of chutzpah, you know, to go out and do that. So thank you. You know, thank you for the teachings. Thank you for the Sangha. All of those things come to my mind when I bow. And thank you for bringing up the subject, something that I could actually relate to.
I guess I would just offer, you know, the woman who left your Sangha because of the difficulty with bowing. be open to the possibility that perhaps it wasn't necessarily a wall, you know, in her mind, you know, that prevented it. Because you said that, and you said that in reference to yourself, but you referenced, mm-hmm. you know, that example and then the other example. You know, it's impossible, it's not difficult, it's impossible to know what happens in another's being, right, what happens in their mind. So be open to the possibility that whatever happened for her as she entered into that space with you may still, in fact, be developing. It may still be an open road. So don't close it in your mind so that she actually has an opportunity, you know, to continue walking. And I guess, you know, the other thing that came up is, which a couple of you have already referenced, so in religious, in quote-unquote religious or overtly religious settings, it's not difficult, we may resist it, but it's not difficult to feel the need for some kind of reverential attitude, whether it's a bow or genuflection, or at the very least a stopping, a slight bow of the head. There's something that happens that these spaces kind of call forth from us. But what if you were, you know, walking, and I was thinking of this because this happens in Mexico all the time. You may be in a completely, you know, run-down neighborhood, and then there will be a tiny little statue of the Virgin, for example. And you will notice the people that will just rush right by and the people who will stop and cross themselves and who will stop deliberately. And the setting, the surrounding, has nothing to do with it. It's that moment, that relationship, as we were talking about with Liam, that communication is happening and is not contingent on the space. That's the kind of freedom, yes. I want.
Yes.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
When I think about bowing, I think about releasing everything, just releasing everything and begging for the teachings, when I can't do that, letting go of that, trying to let go and just bowing, which is, I'm saying that I don't know if I ever actually do it, but it's...
How would you know if you were doing it?
You know, I think I just have to trust that I am, which again is easy to say, but to really deeply have that faith that it's just a bow and that I'm completely offering myself.
Yeah, and when you said release everything, what is it that you're holding on to?
I don't know. I think that's part of it, is I don't know what I'm holding on to. And how could I possibly let go of something that I don't know what it is, unless I just let it happen?
I agree. I think there's times when it's very clear what it is that we're holding on to, either because it's right in front of us or because of the pain, you know, that it brings. And I think there are many other times in which it is really in the release itself, which happens almost despite ourselves or because of some set of circumstances, that we realize, oh, I didn't even know this was a thing. I didn't even know I was holding on to this. And so when you say, how do you know? Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't know until, you know, your forehead is already on the ground and you realize, oh, right, there was still this. But how else would we do it? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanji. I'm working with reverence and disappointment and reverence and surrender where there's imperfection. Can you help me?
Where's the imperfection?
Throughout the 10 directions, high and low, everywhere I look, I see hurting, pain, flaws, transgressions.
And in that, where is reverence?
This river of karma is so vast and so wide, I cannot possibly see to the beginning of it.
I guess I would say, you know, wherever I look, there is disappointment and there's transgression and there's dot, dot, dot. Wherever I look, there it is.
You mean that's the reverence?
Is it? That is what I'm asking, but that is what I would say. Does one exclude the other? Can it? Can one exclude the other?
I guess I was still holding out hope.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We all do. And maybe it's that hope that edges out the reverence. Remember when Dai Roshi used to say, you know, this is hopeless. This is hopeless. And he didn't mean that in a negative way. I think he was really referring to that gap in which hope lives. There is what is. There is what I would like. And in that gap, reverence, how do I want to say this? In that gap, if reverence comes in, then the gap is closed. May your life go well.
Thank you for your answer.
Hello.
This is pretty close.
It's meant to be.
So a couple things. I bow for in representation of humility. I can't be receptive unless I am humble to you, the teacher. I bow to everyone else for a different reason in my mind. I bow because regardless of this skin, this body, this material aspect, these material aspects that we have, we are all one. We all come from the same source. When we die, we all go back to the same source. And it's really almost a reverence to self, a reverence to that oneness. That's why I bow. I think the reason I believe that people have such an issue with bowing is it's that fear of ego loss. You know, you mentioned something. I think it was what was it? It was a story about the rope, how the individual was holding onto the rope out to sea and came to it and then pulled his way back in, right? Yeah. During this session, in certain poses, in certain forms, you know, I start to feel my body going numb. And there's a innate fear, you know, that comes from that, and that loss of ego, and there came a point where I just let go. I just let go and just embraced it. I embraced that ego loss, and I stopped thinking about time. I stopped thinking about, you know, this nagging pain that I might feel. You know, I submitted to the loss of ego. So it's also a form of submittal, you know, of submission, bowing. That's why. And even if you don't feel like like doing it, even if you don't conceptually, you know, understand it, you know, the act of doing it,
I feel it's your body doing it. So ultimately, whether you, let me say it again. So it's conceptually you don't agree with it, but you do it anyway. I feel that doing it time and time again will get you to the point to where you will start to understand, and then vice versa. If you understand how to do it, but you don't actually do it, you don't actually bow, you'll never fully grasp the understanding of that, the submission and that humility. So that's why I bow.
Yeah, I think from the perspective of understanding, from James's perspective, it's never a good idea to surrender the ego because it's a death. That's what I was saying, you know, the other day in the talk, and that story about being at that very edge, the very end of that rope, that tether, and the terrifying moment in which you know that if you let go, you will die. And that is what happens in Zazen, you know, that our body and our mind will do everything, anything that it can to keep itself here. And so, whether it's the word surrender or submitting, as you're saying, that there's a moment in which you can't think your way through that. You can't convince yourself that it's going to be okay. Because James will never believe that it's going to be okay. So something else needs to happen in that moment for that release. That is, frankly, I think, mysterious. Because you can't will it. You can only place yourself in that spot enough times that something happens. And so also when you said, you know, it's like humility for the teacher, I would say, you know, forget the teacher, it's really humility for yourself. For because you can't be receptive unless, you know, there is that full release. You know, that quote of Ajahn Chah that I often will quote, you know, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will be free. And most of us will let go completely just in moments, you know, these very sudden and short moments. But that's okay. That's all that is needed. Because once you've done it once, you know that you can do it again.
Brings back perspective, right? When you go back to your normal life, you can reach back to that time when you let go.
And you see that you're fine. I mean, you know, you did it, and here you are. You're fine. Here we are talking. You know, you didn't disappear in a poof of smoke. You didn't die in the way that you thought you would, right? So that's the thing. From you will never explain it to yourself that it's going to be okay. You have to go through it. You have to take that step and then see you're actually standing on solid ground, which is not solid at all, but it's just a way to talk about it. May your life go well.
Thank you. Okay. Really interestingly, the conversation that was just had flows right into this, but I feel like bowing for me as a personal practice is practice. So I know what to do when I feel my heart being pulled out of my body down to the ground. And I love that someone mentioned bowing to the moon. I feel like I can't make it up the hill without bowing three times at least, or to the fire that burns downstairs. And so for me, as a personal practice, bowing is practice. So that I know how to, when I feel everything around me wanting to wrap me in the teachings, wrap me in what Dogen said, to wrap me in the teachings, that there's a practice for that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that's so alive for me is just this week of bowing as a social practice and what it means to bow to each other. I was allowed into the ritual of the two people I was staying with, the two men I was staying with in the room, and they would just bow three times before going to bed and after waking up, and it was so beautiful. It was so beautiful coming in the Zendo and watching, sitting next to Greg and Christine, and I'm usually late getting in the Zendo, and every time I bowed and they bowed with me, there was so much strength in that moment. And just today, this morning, someone came up to me and said last night, I think like late, pretty late last night in the Zendo, they wanted to thank me because they bowed to their cushion or they bowed to the room and I bowed back. And they were like, that bow saved me, that bow. I just really needed someone to bow back to me. And there's so many aspects to bows.
Isn't it interesting that something so simple can actually save someone? You know, that just it just shows the effect that we have on one another, and how you know, the power of a gesture like a bow. You know, let's not even say a full prostration, but just a gassho, you know, and a seated bow before you take a meal, for example. And if you can't do it, or if you're in a public space and you feel you're not able to bow with your mind, changes that moment. And the reference to the moon, I thought about it when Liam said it, and now that you've brought it up again, it just made me think of St. Francis's Canticle to the Sun, where it's really a song of praise, of celebration, of everything, of the world, of sun and moon and wind and fire, you know, really as manifestations of God. But it was his, and apparently he would sing it. He would actually sing this hymn. And it's a beautiful reminder of this world that I'm in, that I inhabit. And I very much experience it as a bow, is saying, in this moment of bringing up the sun and bringing up water and bringing up fire, I'm bowing with it. I'm bowing as it. That's the moment in which a bow truly is a bow, in which the whole universe bows. You know, to me, that is, which is always true, but is when you know that, when you feel that, that something really transforms, that something changes. And maybe it's what some people have been referring to as that moment where you feel something clicks into place. It's that, and the entire universe is bowing on that mat. May your life go well.
Thank you for this teaching.
You know, when you bow and you take the both sides of your robe and like you're wrapping yourself in it. Do you always do that?
I have no idea. I just do it.
It's like you're wrapping yourself in the Buddha's robe.
So Sanji, this week was a real blessing and privilege to be at Sesshin with you and Hogan. I felt like I was at the fourth turning of the wheel. These teachings and this Dharma being birthed. So bowing is a very important aspect. Bowing is my life.
What do you mean by that?
So my question is...
No, wait. What do you mean by that? But say it so that they can understand. Oh, I don't have a bell. That's too bad.
So my question is this. Even though I love this Dharma, I love this practice, and every session, third day, if I'm lucky, third day, else it's the second day, I've called it bad movie day. So, you know, there are some benefits. You sit long enough, sometimes it actually gets quiet. And then out of the depths of the stillness comes the sea monster with these awful movie clips of just horrifying things I have done. And the worst part of it is that by the time we live to be my age, is the karma is still living. So that, you know, I hear when Stephen spoke about not looking at parts of himself, I was sitting there thinking, that's okay, I can tolerate looking at parts of myself. What I can't stand and I have such anguish with
is these movie clips come up that are just horrifying, starring me, and then there's the karma. And so when, you know, Shoan spoke so deeply about the karma that of all of our lineages, and then the karma that still is being processed, for me, not processed, living, that certainly came out of well-intent. You know, I was sleepwalking, and I obviously still do. So my question is, how do I bow the way I feel I can bow in my life to you, to Hogan, to this life, this precious life? There, the karma that I've created causes anguish, and I find it very difficult to battle it and not just be twisted.
Mm-hmm. But that karma is not static, would you agree?
I agree.
So even though it sounds like it's the same movie that comes up on the third day of Sesshin, more or less, that karma is not... In that moment of watching the movie, it seems like it's frozen in time, but you know that it's not.
Well, but in a way it is, because the karma is rippling.
So how do you shift it? Or how do you let it become exhausted, as the sutras
say?
That's
my... So I try to practice atonement, so when it shows up, I actually viscerally bow, and I'll say I'm deeply sorry. It's still the anguish or the shock lingers, because it's still alive in the ripples.
But what's the anguish about?
That I caused harm.
So when you're saying all evil karma ever committed by me since of all, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, now I atone for it all?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that?
Yeah, but it doesn't go away.
Do you believe that you are actually, that you're capable of atoning for it?
I guess I haven't actually explored that, because I would say no. I guess that's the sticking point, is not feeling the capacity to completely atone, that there's residue.
So I would look at that, and I'm not saying that you just go like this and it just becomes erased. This isn't magical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But in that, because you're speaking about that anguish, and you said you used the word shock. Mm-hmm. It was like you can't believe that you did that.
Right.
But so then what is happening in that moment when you're saying, I atone for it all? That's the place to look.
Thank you for your teaching.
May your life go well. I found a teaching on bowing by Judy Leaf, who was here last weekend offering a retreat. And this is some of what she says. In prostration practice, we visualize everything as included in one vast world. The lineage is before us. Our natural world surrounds us. Our friends and family are at our side. And our enemies are behind us. Animals, crowds of people, and supernatural beings all join in. Nothing is excluded. We never stop prostrating. We take the mental attitude of prostrating ourselves over and over again to our teacher, to basic wakefulness, to the profound teachings of the Buddha, to our companions and fellow beings. And rather than being diminished, we are purified and enriched. So, you know, the statement that I made, that the entire universe is contained in a bow, you know, this is always true. This is never not true. But it only comes alive. It is only made real when there is nothing between us and the world, when there is nothing between us and that bow. And some of you spoke of that getting out of the way, which needs to be an unfolding and continuous process. There's no point at which we stop and say, there, I am done. And so when everything that we are, everything that we believe, that we think, that we see, that we do, that we feel, when everything is inside, that is inside, that is outside, that is underneath, that is above, you know, when all of that, even in an instant, even by accident, when in that moment all of that bows, that is actually what Dogen is speaking of as Dharani, as miraculous transformation. So may we all learn how to bow in such a way. Thank you for your practice.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.